Linda's wedding day, Saturday, December the 9th, began overcast and gray, but with the promise of the sun breaking through. I went in Linda's room early, and there sat Jesse Kellum and Don Thomas, deep in conversation with Linda. Marvin and Jim came and went. Yes, it begins to sound more like it's sure that Lyndon will be leaving for the Texas. Well, one of them brought me a list of guests that might be invited to ride home on Air Force One. On Air Force One, this was both a blessing and a disappointment. Lucy and Patton need to save those two tickets at $85 each. They will surely go. But it will be so hard to pack, to get ready, and to miss all the good times. The family supper upstairs after Linda and Chuck have gone. Diana's party tomorrow afternoon. John Lee had set up shop in the East Hall, and there were several dryers and the screen, the dressing table, Jean-Louis and two assistants, combing hair from 9 o'clock on. Somewhere during the bedlam, I had some lunch in the solarium, the last lunch of our busy house party. And all during the day, I was aware of seeing Warry Lynn, our dear, lovely, chirping Warry Lynn, looking forlorn and sad, when it's she I always look to for cheer. Chief gave Linda Bird a back rub. I went downstairs to look at the final preparations for the wedding. The cake was gorgeous, and the flowers in the tent, the bright profusion of pinks and reds and pale oranges, the paper flowers, and on the table the most beautiful bouquets, an absolute triumph from the flower room, ranging from tenderest pink to deepest velvet red. Chuck came, and at once I loved what he said. How is my little girl feeling? Mm-hmm. Lyndon and I and Chuck and Linda went into the Queen's room, past the gauntlet of bridesmaids, last ones getting their hair combed, and quietly shut the door. And Lyndon's performance as a father was superb. He was so full of tenderness and understanding, wanting to help, discussing the whole situation very quietly. He gave them U.S. savings bond for a wedding present. And then the great wheels of order and convention went to rolling, and I went to get dressed, and Linda went to get dressed. At a few minutes before 4, I took my place at the head of the stairs. Bess, still quiet in all the tumult, was the major domo, and at her signal, I took Brian Lamb's arm and walked down the stairs, past the throngs of wedding guests, in the entrance foyer, and down the hall, masked in the east room, my eyes locking for one brief moment in a message of love to this good friend and that kin person, and another childhood friend of Linda's. I took my place behind the rope, close to Aunt Ellen, who was seated, seeing Tony in the background behind me, and Rebecca, tall and handsome, her hat a mass of ostrich plumes, and across the way on one of the benches, Chuck's 83-year-old grandmother, looking elegant and frail and quite sweet, seated on a bench that we had provided for the elderly or infirm. I was glad that somehow in the unbelievable time before the wedding, I had gone up to the Robb's room for a quiet few minutes' visit with Mrs. Sims, his grandmother. She was surrounded by aunts, her children, and well taken care of. But I wanted her to feel that it was quite special to have her there. Four generations of Robb's sharing in the wedding, with Chuck's two little nieces, after seeing the house, had been invited out by friends. The ceremony began on time, they tell me, with Pat Nugent and Joe Batson coming in first, and then the other groomsmen, and then all the velvet-clad bridesmaids. And Linda had been right all along. It was a stunning color. Each one looked perfectly beautiful. Lucy, looking ethereal and very solemn, was the last to come in, taking her place in a semicircle in front of the altar. And all the time, Chuck, facing forward toward the door, looking firm, strong, and happy. Then the Marine Band struck up the march from Lohengrin. Here comes the bride. Every heart in the place lifted, I'm sure. There was a hushed, expectant moment. And there at the door was Linda on her daddy's arm. Beautiful as she was, it was he I watched all the way. Such a mixture of tenderness and quietness and farewell in his look. His hair looked whiter than I've ever seen it, and I was full of tenderness for him. How would one describe the bride? Queenly, radiant, stunningly beautiful, certainly. And the whole setting was in the grand manner. I have never seen a lovelier ceremony. My heart was a roaring tumult of pride, of desire to wring from this wonderful time every second of pleasure, of the feeling of farewell. The altar was a raised platform on which Canon MacAllister stood, and behind him the window blanked out the great mass of greens in which tiny lights sparkled, and a tall white cross gave the final stamp of a religious ceremony. Chuck's responses were firm and clearly said, Linda's much quieter. And Lyndon's only words, when Canon MacAllister asked, who gives this woman in marriage, he answered, her mother and I. And a ripple of emotion, I thought, went through the crowd. Then he stepped back, I grateful that he was careful of a train, and joined me behind the velvet rope. I remember being startled when I saw, from tiny slits in the white fabric behind the altar, two sets of eyes looking out on the room, and then what was obviously the business end of a camera. Well, actually, it was a great job of camouflage. And I remember how solicitous Lucy was, arranging Linda Bird's train, taking her flowers at the proper moment, offering the ring to Linda for her to put on Chuck's finger. In just 20 minutes, Reverend McAllister said, "You may kiss the bride now." And Chuck leaned over with a big smile and kissed Linda on the cheek. The Marine Orchestra broke into Mendelssohn's wedding march, and she was on his arm, headed across the East Room and out under the arch of swords. But I never saw it, so I'm glad I did yesterday at the rehearsal. Each red velvet-clad bridesmaid on the arm of a groomsman went out, and finally I, escorted by Brian Lamb again, and then taking Lyndon's arm, and we went through the hall, smiling to right and left, this time more relaxed and ready to be joyous. And up the stairs, it had all been glorious, perfect. Linda's wedding dress, of course, was the something new, and it fulfilled every expectation. Long-sleeved, high-collared, white silk satin, its front panel outlined in embroidered silk flowers with seed pearls. It was indeed quite regal. There was a Renaissance feel about it. And I hope I live to see a granddaughter wear it, and I'm sure it will be just as good then. As we mounted the stairs, I gave a fleeting thought to what must be the controlled pandemonium below, because as soon as they could deferentially urge the wedding guests out of the East Room toward the state dining room and the pink tent, as champagne and the big buffet tables awaited them, they would lock the doors, open the window onto the terrace, remove the altar, the marine band would melt away and Peter Duchins would replace it, the screen would come down from in front of the cake, and tables for champagne and refreshments would blossom in the corners. What a job! The master of logistics is Bess, abetted by Mary Kaltman and Mr. West and all this valiant crew. Upstairs, all the wedding party assembled in the yellow room, from which all the furniture had been taken. There was a press pool and a vast array of cameras, and they took pictures in every conceivable grouping. The four of us, and then the six of us, and then all the party, 21 in all, counting the Reverend McAllister. And here we stretched entirely across the oval room, Linda and Chuck right underneath George Washington. Next to him, his mother and then his father, Lyndon standing beside Linda, and then I, and then Lucy. Then the parents were released, and we went out to get a drink and a moment's rest while they took pictures of just the young folks, and then of just the bride and groom. Bess, for the first time I noticed, was looking a little nervous. "No, we couldn't go down yet," she said. And I remembered what a jungle the Blue Room had been. Massed equipment for TV furniture. And furniture waiting to be conveyed into the East Room. Now it was being readied for the receiving line. NBC began a special of the wedding, and for a few minutes we watched it. Linda perched on the arm of a chair, Chuck beside her. Then Bess came and said, "They're ready." Down the six of us went to the Blue Room, Lyndon first in line, with Linda beside him, and then Chuck, and then his mother, and then his father, and I bringing up the end of the line, very much to that polite gentleman's discomfiture, but entirely right in our house, I thought. And the 640-odd guests began filing by. It was slow, because for every one, I had to have a special introduction, and for so many, a kiss and an embrace. TV covered the first 15 minutes. A sizable number of the VIPs showed up here, led off by the Vice President, and Muriel, and the Chief Justice and Mrs. Warren, and Secretary of State and Virginia Rusk. Alice Roosevelt Longworth was among the first, and Lyndon gave her a big hug. She said, to my relief, very fulsome, warm things about how beautiful the wedding was. General Walt and General Wallace Green and General Leonard Chapman were all there. Every member of the cabinet, only 14 senators and their wives had been invited, and everyone had accepted, though I never did actually see Dick Russell at the wedding, and only 8 members of the House. Okay. Senator Dirksen embraced every one of us and planted a large kiss right on my mouth. There were 2 members of the court besides the Chief Justice, Blacks and the Fortuses, and of course the Tom Clarks. And the amazing thing was how many of the ambassadors who had come from so far, Dukes from Spain, the Heaths from Sweden, and even the Eugene Locks from Vietnam, and the George McGee's from Germany. There was a great hugging and kissing when John and Nellie came down the line, with young Johnny now 6 feet, and embraces for the Jim Canes and the Willis Hearst. In fact, it was a hugging and kissing party. So much so that the line went very slow, and an harassed Bess came up to me and said, if it keeps on moving at this rate, it will take 3 hours to do the line. So reluctantly, I tried to hurry up, stopped midway, closed the doors, and sat down for a drink, but went on after about 10 minutes. I had a special squeeze of the hand for Mary Lasca, and I found her in front of me. There was an amazing number of Rob relatives, and I got a thumbnail sketch of each from Mr. Rob as they came down the line. And I, in turn, gave him a sketch of the Bobbitts and the Tony Taylors, Lane Fischessa and Ain Ellen. I could feel the press's blood pressure go up whenever any of Linda's movie friends came along. The elegant Merle Oberon and her interesting husband Bruno Pagliai. And Carol Channing, wearing outrageous yellow mini bloomers that came to mid-thigh, with her nice husband Charles Lowe. And the Henry Fords and Charlotte Ford Nearchus, causing almost as much a flurry. But surprisingly, the Earl and Countess of Bessborough not being noticed at all. Were plenty of old beaux. Mike Fenner and Dave Lefevre and John Loeb and Paul Dresser. And there were other members of the four, crowd that had always gone together at O. Henry Junior High. Julie Valentine, now Miss Carlos Puentes, and Kristen von Chrysler, finishing up her master's in California. And Pam Ward, now Mrs. Brian Medgen, a housewife and mother. And there were friends from NCS, Jane Taylor and Jennifer Urquhart, and Jill McKelvey, Jan Nichols, and a host of NCS teachers, beginning with Miss Lee. And the tallest man in the room, John D. Rockefeller IV, with Sharon, demure and dainty, at his side. And our old neighbors, Dr. and Mrs. Reed. And here Lyndon stopped the line a minute to explain to the press that he had raised them both, our girls. It was wonderful, every moment of it. And it lasted all of 2 hours. About 7:15, the last guest went down the line. And then the six of us went into the East Room, where Lyndon and I and Chuck and Linda walked up on the platform where the cake sat. Someone brought Chuck's sword, and with their two hands on the handle, they cut the first piece. This Linda shared with Chuck. Lyndon took the sword and cut another big slice, and I had a bite of it. Absolutely delicious. Pound cake with white raisins and a trace of rum or some liquor and luscious white icing. And then, in a swirl, so that I do not quite remember who danced with who first, there was Lyndon and Chuck, and Lyndon and her daddy, I with Mr. Rob, and then Lyndon cut in on me, and with a big smile, he said, you sure have been making it up for that purple dress. One of the light touches of the day. And how many of the dear touches he contributed was his referring to our wedding at least 3 times, and always laughingly, with some reference to my awful purple dress. Everyone had rushed into the East Room for the cutting of the cake, so it was madly crowded, and we were dancing in a small circle, and I was glad to escape. The bridesmaids and groomsmen were dancing, and then it was no time until I heard a flurry of excitement, and then people were saying, she's about to throw her bouquet. I was in the green room, and I couldn't possibly make my way to where I could really see her. So behind a sea of backs, I heard the rising ripple of excitement as Linda threw her bouquet and Warlin caught it. And then she was off upstairs, and that was the last that the wedding guests saw of her. I found Mrs. Hudspeth and sat with her on the sofa in the green room, Daniel Webster's, I believe it was, and we had a loving talk about Linda, who is as dear as a daughter to her. I asked that Diana take charge of getting the kinfolks up on the second floor any time after the crowd began to thin out. And I circled through the red room, the state dining room, the blue room, the main hall, visiting with everybody and trying to absorb every minute of it to remember. Somehow, I never got to the tent. There were two guests that I had studiously tried to prevent from coming to the wedding. Yuki, I didn't want him to come at all. He had made his appearance when we'd all gathered in the yellow room upstairs to have our pictures done, wearing a bright red blanket on which congratulations was spelled out in sequins. Liz has often said that Mr. Trafees Bryant ought to be an assistant press man. He gets Yuki ready and in on every occasion. The other guest was an unwitting one, little Patrick Lynn, and we had conspired, Lucy and Pat and I, to see that he did not make his appearance until Linda had tossed her bouquet and gone. Both of them came to me frantically and separately, right after the cake cutting, to say that the president was asking for him. I advised them to go in another direction and make no answer, But, alas, Lyndon won, and Patrick Lyndon came down for a brief visit, during which, I am told, he stood on the piano and walked with help. However, he was promptly whisked away by Lucy, but returned again, brought by his grandfather, after the bride had thrown her bouquet. And this time he visited around with everyone, looking very proper in his black suit with the little white stripe in the pants. He went to sleep with his head on his grandfather's shoulder, and at 9:15, Lyndon left from the South Grounds, taking Lucy and Pat and Lynn and a helicopter full of guests. Others had gone on ahead to Air Force One at Andrews. The kinfolks had assembled on the second floor. Patsy and Buzz Cheney and Aunt Ellen and Elaine and Roxanne had flown over from Europe just for the wedding. Jack and Gary Hopkins, it was a particular joy to me to have them here. Diana in charge. Donald had gone home early. He must still be careful. Tony and Matiana, having the most fun of anybody except me, and my attractive young cousins, the Griffin Tatums. I was so sorry to lose Ava Cox, and particularly Becky Alexander, whose coming to the wedding at all was a happy surprise. She looked very thin, but I noticed that she had on an elegant white dress. Lucy told me that when she asked about her daddy and mother, she was just noncommittal. She, Lucy, tried to speak to all the kinfolks before her hasty departure. I saw that everybody had a drink and then went downstairs to survey the scene for the last time. The young folks were taking over. It was 9:00 and everybody was dancing. I asked Mrs. Robb to stop by and visit with us all before they went on to a late supper party for their Arizona friends. But I think she had her hands full with kinfolks. Back upstairs, I saw Linda coming down the hall, quite calm and contained, in a beautiful geranium red coat dress with a striped scarf. Patsy slipped some rice in my hand. I gave them both one loving farewell kiss. She spoke a word or two to the relatives. We all flung rice, and then the elevator swallowed them up, and they were gone. She had looked pensive, like she was already far away from us. So then it was really over, and I took the kinfolks round the dining room table where we loaded our plates copiously. I discovered that I was famished. And then we all went in the treaty room. Sam Houston came in, helped by one of the chiefs, and Becky and Bobbitt and Philip. We had a big TV set in the room, and communications had taped the specials all day for us. NBC's at 5, ABC's at 7, and one last night from CBS. We played all of these while we ate. ABC's by all odds the best. And I saw more of the wedding than I had seen while living through it. Yeah. Linda's wedding dress, of course, had been the something new. And the little bonnet pin that had been worn to a party where General Lafayette was the guest of honor. The pin had been given to Linda by Mrs. Hudspeth. It was the something old. It had been sewn carefully inside. Great-grandmother Ruth Ahmet Huffman's handmade handkerchief was the something borrowed. And inside the hem of the dress, Linda Bird Johnson, December the 9th, 1967, the White House, was embroidered in blue. It was 11:30 when I said goodbye to the kinfolks. Chief Dawson had been waiting for me. I settled in the complete luxury of a massage while I watched TV and went to bed almost alone in the house about 12:30. Of our house party, there only remained Sam Houston and the three Robs upstairs, and Phyllis Bonanno. And so this great day in my life slipped into history.